following the passing of the Enabling Act, the first thing that the legislature did was to pass a bill granting the suffrage to the women of Alaska. Of course, we made some rather pertinent comments on that, that they wanted to give the idea of the population being much larger than it is at the time, because we really had comparatively few people in the whole territory, and it didn't look very imposing. Mm-hmm. So they decided they'd include the women. Well, after the legislature was over, I'm not quite sure as to the exact date or month. It was in 1913, I believe in the month of November, that a notice appeared in the Newsminer that there would be a meeting for the women at the federal courthouse. At that time, it was on 2nd and Cushman. And there was no name given or no organization mentioned as to who was calling the meeting, just simply a meeting for the women. So we all knew each other in those days. We got together and we decided we'd go and see what it was all about. At that time, my baby was born in April, and May, June, July, August, September, October, November. She was 7 months old. And Bob, who was running the store, was very, very busy. However, he said, if you want to go, Jesse, I'll close up the store and come back and babysit for you. So I arranged with Mrs. Zimmerman, who was the wife of a mining engineer, and they also had some mining property out, I believe, on Fairbanks Creek. Anyway, she said she would come, and she came down to pick me up to go to the meeting that evening. And accompanying her was Mrs. Ferguson and Mrs. Abe McKinnon, both pioneers. I believe Mrs. McKinnon had come in over the Chilkoot Pass. Her husband was working for the Road Commission, and Mrs. Ferguson's husband was connected with the Independent Lumber Mill. She's the mother of Forbes Baker. So the three of us set out for the courthouse, and we were only living about a block away from the courthouse. We were living on 3rd between Cushman and Lacey, and the courthouse was on 2nd and Cushman. Well, we came into the meeting. There were several women there already, and we were all sitting. At first they thought they could hold the meeting in one of the smaller rooms, but then they found they'd have to hold it in the large courtroom. And as we came into the large courtroom, as near as I can remember, there was a blackboard, and there was Ed Wickersham, who I believe was a cousin of Judge Wickersham's. He was the only man there. And Mrs. Pratt, that's the mother of the late Judge Pratt, she was in the chair. She had come up probably about a year before from Colorado, from Denver. Her husband also was a judge. And Colorado had granted the suffrage to women a short time prior to that. So we got into the meeting. I can't really recollect how many women there were in the hall, but it would be safe to say that pretty nearly every woman that could possibly get away in the camp was at this meeting. So Mrs. Pratt said, the meeting will now come to order, and we'll ask Mr. Wickersham to explain to us what a ballot is like. On the blackboard there was a ballot. Just as Mr. Wickersham was getting up to explain something, Mrs. Zimmerman stood up and she said, well, it seems to me there's no necessity to tell us what a ballot is like. We're all experienced older women, and we come here to just discuss the importance of the vote. And it so happens that at this particular time we have with us some women who have already worked actively for suffrage and who've already come from states that have the suffrage. And she mentioned Lena Morrow Lewis, who had worked for the suffrage movement for a number of years. And then she mentioned Viola King Kelly, who had come from Oregon. And Viola and her husband, King Kelly, had only recently taken a trip, their honeymoon trip, from Athabasca Landing all through the Pelly River and Peace River country, and finally portaged and did all the most difficult things of traveling across that type of terrain. So when they reached Fort Yukon, I'm talking about the Kellys now, Mrs. Kelly found she was expecting a baby, and it would have been too difficult for her to go home to Oregon, where she had been teaching school. And so she decided she would stay on at Fairbanks until after the baby came. And her husband, King, he had written several short stories for what was at that time, I think there was a magazine called The Cosmopolitan. He wrote for some of the more prominent magazines, and he thought he would be doing some writing and it'd be all right if he spent the winter in here. And then Mrs. Zimmerman said, and we also have with us Mrs. Robert Bloom, just one of our own residents who has worked on the suffrage movement in London. And now she says, I'll call on Mrs. Kelly to tell us some of her experiences recently in working for the suffrage in Oregon. So Mrs. Kelly stood up. When Mrs. Zimmerman finished, the women in the room clapped, applauded. So we realized then that the meeting had left Mrs. Pratt's hands and gone into the hands of Mrs. Zimmerman. So Mrs. Kelly stood up and she talked for a while and said that she had had the privilege of voting for the first time in Oregon after they got the vote. And she mentioned that when she went down to this election, there was an old lady following her. This old lady was 80 years of age. And she said the tears were coming down this old lady's eyes. She was crying to think with gratitude that she had been given the privilege of actually living to see Oregon granting the vote to the women. Well, then Mrs. Kelly sat down. Then Mrs. Zimmerman said, well, we have here Mrs. Lena Morrow Lewis, who's been active for a number of years in the suffrage movement. Mrs. Lewis was a much older woman than Mrs. Kelly or myself. So Mrs. Lewis got up and she gave us a very short, concise history of the women's suffrage movement in the United States, bringing in that little bit about the time the territory of Wyoming had appealed to the Washington to become a state, and Washington was willing to accept them but not their women. Well, they claimed as the women for a number of years had always taken part in the territorial meetings in connection with their government, that they wouldn't become a state unless their women could come with them. So as a result of that, Wyoming was the first state that had granted suffrage to the women, and they came in. Then Mrs. Zimmerman said, We'd like to hear from Mrs. Bloom. She's had some first-class practical experience with working for the suffrage movement. So I got up and I said, as far as I can size up the situation, here in Alaska we come unprepared because we haven't had to struggle for it. Whereas back home, I said, we are very well prepared because we've read up all we can on the not only on the political situation, but on the economic situation. So I think in those circumstances, we'd be wiser to go slow before we look at a ballot box on the blackboard. Then Mrs. Pratt spoke up and she said, that's a very good idea. In Colorado, we did form a series of civic clubs. Then, I can't remember exactly, we discussed civic clubs for a short time, and one lady suggested that we form a civic club, and that motion was seconded. Then the question arose as to, we would have to meet again to further discuss a civic club. We weren't interested in the vote any longer. We were interested in finding out what it was all about. So we had quite a little discussion about when to form the civic club. However, we adjourned the meeting, agreeing to meet the following 2 weeks, or I can't remember exactly when, but prior to a general election that was coming up. And we would invite all the candidates for this general election, if they wished to come forward, or if it wasn't convenient for them to attend. At that time, people did work very hard, and it was difficult to get over here, or whatever way it was. They could send in a paper, a written report of what they intended to, what their platform was. So the meeting adjourned on that. Now, the next meeting, of course, was the meeting when the candidates were presenting their platform, and that took place 2 weeks later. Well, when I came home and told Bob about it, well, he says, I'm going to the next meeting, you're staying home. So I said, all right, you can go and I'll stay home. So at the next meeting, there had been a change of administration, and Judge Irwin was appointed Marshal of the 4th Division. And he was at this meeting. The date of the meeting arrived, and all of the men and the women were at this meeting, but I wasn't. I was at home taking care of the baby, and I had to depend on Bob for my report. Well, according to him, it was some meeting. Dan Callahan and the newly appointed marshal almost had a free-for-all about something. And I don't know exactly what occurred, but as time went on, Dan Callahan was railroaded out of here on some trumped-up charge. The date that they said that he had been molesting some native girls was a date when he had been working for the Road Commission, and the records of the Road Commission showed that every means of communication was so difficult at that time that Dan was sent to McNeil Island for a year. It was only after he got into McNeil Island, he had been protesting his innocence, that they were able to get hold of the records of the Road Commission and show exactly how he had been working on that date. So he had to be permitted, taken out of McNeil Island. Of course, there had to be bonds put up for a retrial for him. And James Fowle, I think it was, who had a men's store on First and Cushman, and Bob Bloom, my husband, were the only two that went on his bail. And the president of this university, Judge Bunnell, he was the man that was on the bench when Dan was sent out. So there was a very decided disagreement between this faction and the other. Well, time passed on, and Dan had his retrial, and Dan, of course, was exonerated, because the pay sheet of the Road Commission showed where Dan was. Well, then Dan was elected to the next session of the legislature, and the legislature required money the college required money for the legislature. And the Right Honorable President Bunnell was there to try and get his money. Well, shall I go on further?
Well, why don't we go back?
Yes, go back.
I'll put this down as Bunnell and Callahan.
I'm not doing anything I shouldn't do, am I?
No. Why don't we go back to the meeting now? You were saying it.
Yes.
Bob was going to report back to you on what happened. You said that
yes.
Marshall and Dan Callahan almost got in this quarrel at the meeting, was this?
Well, you can do a little questioning now.
Sure.
After this.
How did the meeting turn out? Did most of the candidates show up there for the
women's meeting? Oh, yes, they showed up and they formed a civic club, and it finally became the Women's Temperance, the WCTU, isn't that
mm-hmm.
it? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we had our prohibition, they worked for prohibition, and
mm-hmm.
but it was eventually a number of other smaller organizations grew out of it as the population increased.
I see.
But the women have always been very well treated in Fairbanks. I'm using that in its broadest sense,
mm-hmm.
because some of the very good federal and state and territorial positions that could be occupied by women were.
Mm-hmm. What women's groups sprang up during the First World
War? Pardon?
What women's groups sprang up during the First World War here?
What women's groups were active in the First World
mm-hmm.
War?
In
well, the Red Cross was here,
mm-hmm.
and the auxiliaries, the Women's Auxiliary, no, let me get it straight, the Episcopal Guild and the Presbyterian Ladies' Aid and the Catholics there, most of the church
mm-hmm.
organizations, they worked during the First World War. But we were very remote. There's a picture of the First World War in my mind. We were so far removed
mm-hmm.
from the scene of that even though they sent us up lots of the ersatz, I don't know the English word, it doesn't come to me, that we had to use for flour instead of, there was a shortage of flour. I'll take the First World War as a separate thing altogether,
okay.
Yes.
How were you familiar with how the WTC...
With who, Colonel?
The Women's Temperance League, was it?
The Women's Christian...
Women's
no,
Christian.
I wasn't familiar with that. It happened that I went out... my second baby was born in December of 1914, and I left here in July of 1914 and went back to Ireland and had my second baby in Ireland. So I returned in August of 1916, and by that time the Civic Club was very active, and the Women's Christian Temperance Union was just beginning to be, to work.
Mm-hmm. What kind of activities did the Civic Club get involved with, political candidates?
Well, the activities of the Civic Club, well, first they had classes in parliamentary law, how to conduct a meeting,
mm-hmm.
and I really wasn't, how shall I put it? I wasn't active in the Civic Club. It was just organized right about that time. It took all of 6 months
mm-hmm.
to get working and to get notepaper and things like that in.
Mm-hmm.
You really time was a very, very lucid sort of thing
mm-hmm.
in those days. Our big mail only came in on about the 4th of July on the first boat. You know all
right.
of that, yes. You know, we had to use we didn't even have any books to in civics, because there was only the school library, and the George C. Thomas Library didn't really have anything constructive. And actually the movement, the women's suffrage movement in the states itself weren't prepared, where they were just gradually growing.
When did you first become involved with the Girl Scouts and Girl Scout program?
Well, I've got that all down in that Girl Scout history what is the lady's name?
Mrs. Davis.
Pardon?
Mrs. Davis.
Mrs. Zadis?
Davis.
Oh, Mrs. Davis.
Right.
Yes. Yes. Well, if Mrs. Davis reads it now, all right. If not, we can take it again.
We would like to Xerox that if we could.
Pardon?
We would like to Xerox that or copy that if you would let us.
Yes. Well, the Girl Scouts themselves, she can keep that copy she has, and I get another one from the Girl Scouts. The only thing is, I may have some notes on that. See, I wrote that up for Mrs. Jones when I returned here in 37, and we're not being recorded now, are we?
Turned off the
mic. Yes. Us to use what material we had right here on hand, and we encouraged. Now, in 1917, wasn't it? Well, April of 1917 was when America entered the war.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that Bob came home and we were talking, and he said, I've asked Van Bibber to put in an extra couple of fields of his in carrots for us, because the farmers have had a meeting and decided that, through the Civic Club, decided that in order to save transportation, anything that we possibly can grow in here, we're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, that wheat that Bob was interested in, you know about that.
Mm-hmm.
That had already matured. So he said, I've got Van Bibber to put in a couple of extra fields of carrots for us, also turnips and potatoes, and we won't have to have anything shipped in for us as far as we can possibly manage. Well, you know how we used to ship in our outfits a year ahead of time. Mm-hmm. You've got all of that. Well, all of that stuff was in here, and we happened to have enough staples in the warehouses of sugar and flour and cornmeal and rice and all those, and dried fruits. So it was the fresh things that we needed. Well, when the harvest was ready, we had all those nice carrots, and we had a place in our basement in the sand to keep them. We also took our celery and dug it up with the roots and all, and put those down in the basement. We could manage to have fresh celery till after New Year's Day. Celery that had been grown, well, no freezing.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we always did have, as what we used to call, our cold storage plant on the back porch. You put everything out on the back porch. If there was anything leftovers, it all went out on the back porch. And then when you were hard up for a quick meal, you brought in a little can of this. Well, it wasn't in cans. We put it on a cardboard.
Oh.
And it would freeze solid, brought it in. We didn't use tin foil, we didn't have the tin foil. Or we had some little tins that they could stay on,
mm-hmm.
and bring it in and thaw it out slowly.
What other women's groups were active at this time or began at this time besides this?
What did they do to?
What other groups began? Were there other groups besides?
Well, the active women groups in here were all groups that were connected with the church.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any women's group here that was non-church.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. No, I'm not sure whether the Pioneer Women weren't yet organized. They organized in 1906. And the Eastern Star didn't organize till about 1912 or 13. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the Rebeccas or the Eagle Ladies, no, the only groups were the church groups.
Mm-hmm.
But the church groups were very broad-minded. The Episcopals helped the Catholics at their affairs, and mm-hmm. the Presbyterians helped the others at their affairs. There weren't any Jewish people to make it an organization, but we always helped when the Episcopals women put on their really swell tea. I let them have my Sabbath candles for the tea table. And we had that kind of a ecumenical, is that mm-hmm. the word?
Right.
Yes. Oh yes, we had that from the very early days.
Mm-hmm. Were there very many people of Jewish heritage here?
No, we were there was Mrs. there may have been three or four Jewish women mm-hmm. here in the early days, and our family was the only Jewish family that remained here. You'll get most of that in that thing that I wrote up for the American Jewish Archives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That covers it fairly well, mm-hmm. yes. And Bob remembers and worked with me on that.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few outstanding women that contributed a great deal to the development of the country. And one, I would say, was Dr. Aline Baskerville. She came in here with her husband in 1906. She was a graduate of the Pennsylvania Woman's College, a remarkably capable woman. And she was leader in the Presbyterian choir. She also had a beautiful voice. Now, Doctor's career was a very unusual one. Her husband had suffered from asthma, and that was one of the reasons why he gave up his practice in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where Doctor herself was also practicing, and they came up to Fairbanks. They arrived in Fairbanks in 1906. They were out on a bear hunt. And the guide at the bear hunt was a man named James Bradley. Then a few years later, Dr. Baskerville died in normal, natural circumstances. And Doctor married the guide, James Bradley. In the meantime, there had been a failure in the bank, and the assets of the bank in some way got into the hands of there was a question of what was to be done with the assets in the bank. The bank really wasn't broke. They had enough mortgages and enough ground to cover their liabilities. But they appointed, what do they call him, the fellow?
Receiver? Or?
Yes. And he he was a good man. But the president of the bank went off to Seattle, and so did the other members of the bank. They acted as though they were guilty. Anyway, Doctor was responsible for having an organization to protect the assets in the bank. And Noyes, who ran the mill, was appointed, it isn't administrator, is the
executor or judge or?
No, well, whatever the
the receiver.
It's like administrator, not adjudicator. Well, anyway, the feeling ran very high because nearly everybody had been depositing their money in this bank. There was some kind of legal action taken. Then the legal action was taken, which exonerated to a certain extent the bank officials. So this particular organization, the doctor, was connected with the depositors' organization, staged a demonstration and burnt in effigy the judge and the attorneys. I guess that was enough. Anyway, one of the attorneys, do we mention names?
If you'd like to, I think it's fine.
It was all recorded in the newspaper.
Sure.
Was John Clark, and his wife was a very, very fine woman and very proud, and she could never forgive Doctor for having been instrumental in having her dear John burnt in effigy. That started another feud.
Who were some of the other women who you felt were outstanding during this?
Well, of course, we had Mary Lee Davis, who wrote three or four books on. You've heard of her, haven't
mm-hmm.
you?
Mm-hmm.
She was a great, very dear friend of mine. And we had, of course, Mrs. Zimmerman.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't very many college graduates in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Zimmerman stands out as being one of the graduates of Bryn Mawr.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Lee was Wellesley, and she she got her master's at Radcliffe, and she was a very outstanding person. Mrs. Clegg, I don't think she graduated, but Mrs. Hess did.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember now. I think that, but apart from that, there was the type of woman that was in here when I came in was a woman that could turn her hand to anything. And one of the most outstanding women, I would say, was Mrs. Herring.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you've heard of her,
right,
yes.
Right.
Well, now, I've often gone to visit Mrs. Herring, and when she'd be doing the dishes, she had on her windowsill a book with quotations. I think it was called Gems of English Literature. I'll have to ask the girls what it was. And she'd memorize some of those pieces. Just as she would say, she'd say she might as well keep her mind on something worthwhile while she was doing them. She was really a very remarkable woman, kept an open house for everybody. In fact, only a short few days ago, I was out with her youngest daughter, Betty, and we were talking about something, and Betty said, I always knew there was somebody new came to town, because when Mother had baked a fresh batch of rolls, I'd have to go down there and give them some rolls.
I see.
Well, now let's hear what I've said, because I think I've said it.
This is a continuation of the interview with Mrs. Jessie Bloom on August 5th, 1970, here at the University of Alaska Archives.
Now, for some time early in November of 1918, we had been hearing rumors of the cessation of hostilities, and we were eagerly awaiting word. It had been arranged that the NC whistle, which always made announcements of importance to the citizens would be blown on that night. It was a very cold night, and suddenly, I would say about a little before midnight, the whistle blew. And Bob and I were just talking, and I said, "Bob, the war is over." And he dozed off to sleep, and then I banged him on the head again. I said, "The war is over." And he says, "Well, what can I do?" Well, anyway, the next morning we were exchanging experiences. The rector at the Episcopal Church, Lumley, I believe was his name, he was up, he jumped up out of bed, went down to the church and began to ring the bell, and his nightshirt was above his knees, and he froze his knees, so he knew that the war was over. Then the next morning, I had my kindergarten class, there were just five of them, and I took them out to walk through the town. There were hardly anybody in the town at that time, because most of the able-bodied men had gone out to work either in the shipyards or were in the army. And there was just older people and women and children. And I don't know approximately what the population was then, but I don't think it was even more than 1,000 or perhaps 1,500 all told. However, the children walked along Front Street and they were singing, I can't really remember. It was a little song they learned, "The War is Over." And everybody that had the different stores that had any candy filled sacks with candy and gave it to the children, much like they would on Halloween. However, we got back home, and then the fraternal orders arranged a big celebration where they had all of the patriotic songs and rather nice patriotic speeches, and it was quite an event. Well, I think that gives the picture of one person's reaction to the armistice. Now, I myself think that we have a very interesting analysis, I would say, of the rapid transit that has developed since those days, or the rapid means of communication. It happened that early in June, when this, isn't that funny how words, the Slavonian prince was assassinated, which we consider to be the start off of the war. We never for a moment thought of associating that with a world war. And I was expecting my second baby, and Bob decided that I should go outside. So I got on board a boat early in July, I would say about the 19th of July, and we were on our way probably close to Gibbon, and it was continuous daylight, and some of the passengers on the boat got off the boat at Gibbon, went up to the signal corps. It was Eagle. They went up to the signal corps station at Eagle, and there was a notice pasted on the board: "Germany has invaded Belgium. England and France are mobilizing." And there must have been about five or six of the passengers that came back with this notice. And these are one of the main things on board the boat to keep us interested was playing jokes on each other. So they said, "No, we're not playing any jokes on you, it's the truth." But betting ran high right away whether they were playing jokes or it was really the truth. And by the time we got to Dawson,
We knew it was the truth because they were already landing the wounded at Dunkirk. Now, the reason why I mention this, even it actually took us several days between Eagle and Dawson till we could confirm that that wasn't a joke that the Signal Corps boys had pulled on us, because we'd come up and waken them at 1 o'clock in the morning.
I see.
Then when we got into Dawson, of course, there were several volunteers were already going outside, but there was two old trappers, and they said to me they were going out on the hills because they wouldn't stay in civilization again if there was going to be a war. I've often wondered what happened to them. Then, well, my experience is all through the Sinn Féin Rebellion, but that's got nothing to do with Alaska, so I think we'll drop them. The organization of the kindergarten, this brings us back to 1918. And my youngest child was born on September the 18th, 1918. And all that summer, the children were playing outdoors. And there were four or five children who were just on the edge of being six to get into the first grade. We didn't have any kindergarten at that time. And the other children that were going to be eligible for kindergarten, for first grade, were very envious of them. So one of my neighbors, who had two children, one ready to go into the first grade and one not old enough, so we got to talking, and I said, well, I'll tell you what. I like the way the children are playing around here so nicely. After Ruth comes, I didn't know she'd be Ruth, but after my baby comes, and as soon as I feel equal to it, I think I'll start a little class and take your Pat, and I'll take Josephine, and I have my own Debbie. Well, Mita wasn't even eligible for first grade, so I have two of my own, and Barbara Woodward. There were five of them. And every day at 1 o'clock, the other children would come up to the house carrying their lunch, and they were all ready for school, and we had our little kindergarten class. And that went on from 18 to 22. And by that time, this small kindergarten class was such a success that we were able to convince the school board that we should have a regular kindergarten attached to the public school system.
What kind of things did your kids...
Then I did... You remember me sending you... Well, that was how I happened to do this kindergarten reading course, mm-hmm. and work in with the children. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned some time ago, among the books that I read was one, The Montessori Method and A Montessori Mother. So there were several of the ideas espoused by Montessori that I was able to utilize in my kindergarten. And one in particular was the game of silence. In the Montessori Method, if I'm correct in my memory, you put the word silence on the board and the children all kept quiet. But at the suggestion of the children, I was able to bring in the silence game to cover many and many a situation. One in particular that comes to mind was a walk that we took along the Valdez Trail. It must have been about 1920. And I had about six or seven children with me, and my own two were in the sled. That was Olga and Ruth. And we were walking along. The children played a game in those days that called Angels. The trail was very narrow, and on both sides of the trail there were banks of snow. And the children divided into teams and would lay down in the snow and form an angel in the snow. And the game was to see who could form most angels, the right side of the road or the left side. So they continued with this game, and suddenly in the distance we saw a dog team, and we heard the driver of the dog saying something. The children said, "Oh, he's saying something." And I said, "Yes, I know he's saying something, but what is he saying?" I said, "We'll just play silence now. I want you children all to come close to me, and we'll all say silence, and we'll see if we can hear what he's saying." So we stood there in the middle of the trail and listened. And he said, "My dogs are fresh. They have never seen little people. Get the children off the road, and I think I can get past you." So we went into the snow there, and we all stayed very quietly, played another game of silence, and he passed us up. And of course he knew enough then to stable his horses outside of town. Had he not realized with the upsetting effect that the children had on his young dogs, he may have brought the dogs into town. Well,
what kind of things did you do with the children? You taught them reading, you said.
Pardon?
What kinds of things did you do with the children? You said you taught them reading.
I can't quite hear.
What kinds of things did you do with the children?
Oh, what kinds of things did I do with the children? Well, we, for instance, we played the game, "Here we go around the mulberry bush." And in the mulberry bush, you react several of the ordinary things you do, wash your clothes, clean your teeth, one thing or another. And I had each of the children make a suggestion of a particular action. I remember this in particular because we were all to wash our clothes, and Debbie was standing there doing nothing. I said, "Well, aren't you going to wash your clothes?" "No," she said, "I have a washing machine." And at the regular public school, the primary teacher, Mrs. Kelly, I talked it over with her before I started anything, and she said, "Any material or anything that I have on hand, you're perfectly welcome to, and anything that way in which I can help you." And she suggested drawing simple outlines like an apple or an orange, and then letting the children have pins and prick them out. Mm-hmm. And of course we didn't have any regular kindergarten material, so we had to make up our own material. Then we even saved the center of the prunes, the nuts of the prunes, and we put them together and formed geometric figures. And then the older children were doing the Palmer method at that time, and of course there was a lot of exercises with it. They said they'd like to learn to write. So I said, "All right, you can learn to write." And they were all sitting writing very diligently, and all of a sudden Pat Herring looked at me. "Oh, Mrs. Bloom, may I stop? My arm is getting dizzy." Then another time we ran out of crayons when they were drawing apples, and one little girl said, "Well, I'm going to draw an apple." She just had a brown crayon. She said, "I'll draw my apple and it'll be rotten." She drew it with the brown crayon. It was really a very, very pleasant, association for me, and the children were very good. Incidentally, at that time, Mary Lee Davis got me some kindergarten records of the old kindergarten tunes and the nursery rhymes, a very fine set of them, and we were able to use that in our marches and drills. And the time went by very quickly. Now, did I tell you very much about Dr. Bigler? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember.
She was this doctor that was connected with the bank.
Yes.
Yes. Well, eventually, Doctor, Jim Bradley, the hunting guide, had some mining ground, and there was some legal work in connection with the mining ground, and the legal fees were so very high, the doctor decided she'd study law. So she studied law, and it was a simple matter in those days. You stood an examination before the local bar. A doctor got the examination, but she couldn't clarify her citizenship. So eventually she did find out that her first husband was an Irishman named Baskerville, who had never really become a citizen, or there was no record of it, though he had qualified as a doctor and practiced medicine for a number of years in the States. And Jim Bradley was a French-Canadian. He actually was an American adopted by a French-Canadian family. And he had no record of a citizenship. So then doctor had to take out her citizenship herself. And then she was she practiced law for a while, but not for very long. She married in 1918. Oh yes, Bradley died in 1918. And that was when she had the trouble about her citizenship. Mm-hmm. She married in 1919. She married Mike Bigler. He was of German descent, but he had his citizenship. And they married and lived very happily till he passed on, I think in about 1928 about 1928 Mike passed on. And then doctor was living in Los Angeles at the time. And then she never practiced in California, but she always kept up her license, paid her license fee. And during the Depression, there wasn't any work to speak of. But she took a position with a very wealthy family. The mother in this family became mental, was very depressed, and there were two older girls. And doctor took care of her and made many notes on her reactions. And doctor was telling me how she finally brought her out. At that time, people were bobbing their hair, cutting their hair. And this lady, one of her weaknesses was that she took no interest whatever in her appearance. And one day they were driving out in the car. They had a chauffeur and were driving through the streets of Los Angeles. They happened to be passing a beauty parlor. And some girls came out of this beauty parlor and they looked very smart. So this lady turned to doctor and she said, "I think I'll have my hair cut." Doctor stopped the car immediately and took her into the beauty parlor, and she had her hair cut. And doctor kind of, they came home, didn't look very striking, but they managed the family to make her feel that she looked different and looked much better. Mm-hmm. And then gradually that awakened an interest in her appearance, and she, I don't know whether to say she got perfectly all right, but it certainly was a step in the right direction. During the time that doctor was in Fairbanks, she was appointed city physician. And one of the first things she did was to go down to the two dairies that were here then, Bentley's and Hinckley's. And she examined the cows, and she found there were many tubercular cows there, because there had been quite an evidence of tuberculosis among the children who were drinking the fresh milk. So she wanted to get something done about the cows, but the opposition to her was so strong that not only did she lose her position as city physician, but they continued using the milk to prove that she was wrong. But of course they couldn't. A couple of the kids were left with evidence of tubercular glands because of their stubbornness. And it wasn't until 1925, I believe, that we got a proper government inspector in here and got the cows inspected, and they burnt down and had all the cows killed. There were, I don't think, 25 or 30 cows in the camp at the time, and every one of them were infected, and the dairies had actually to be burned down. Now that's your civilization when a woman is trying to be a do something. Now, I did tell you a good deal about Mary Lee, didn't I, the last time? Yes, I did, I remember. I didn't tell you very much about Fay Hurley. Fay was a very, very fine woman. Her husband was an attorney in here. And during the Second World War was when Fay worked in the American Women's Voluntary Services. That was the organization that most of us worked in during the Second World War. Mrs. John White, who was the wife of the manager of the PAA, she had some friends back in New York who were sending us, who were paying the express charges on any clothes that we would collect as bundles for Britain. Because we didn't enter into the Second World War immediately. Britain had been fighting from, wasn't it August 1939, and we went into that in Pearl Harbor, 41. Well, from August 1939 to Pearl Harbor, we still were working with bundles for Britain or whatever we could do for the Allies in the Second World War. Then this gentleman who had offered to pay wrote to her and told her he was very sorry, but he had other commitments now. This was immediately following Pearl Harbor. So then Mrs. White suggested that we organize a unit of the American Women's Voluntary Services and see what we could do. So we organized that unit of the American Women's Voluntary Services, which was flexible enough for us to undertake any war activities at all connected with the women. And that was when I was appointed chairman of the children's board, because we weren't sure whether we'd be bombed or what, and we thought, Mrs. McDonald worked with me on the committee for the children, we might have to take the children if we were bombed, or we'd better, by the wisest thing for us, the children of up to school age could be taken care of by the teachers, but it was the children of preschool age that we were most concerned with. So we went round and we got the list of the children in here of preschool age. There weren't very many, because most of the dependents on the military and the others had to go, were sent out. Mm-hmm. I would say there was approximately about 25 children of preschool age in and around the camp. Well, we listed them, and we arranged for little meetings with those children so that they would know each other and that we would get to know them too, and those of us who were working on our committee would get to know them. So all that winter from of 1941, we worked on getting to know the children. There was one rather interesting thing in the defense program, I don't know what you could call it exactly, but the women had organized that in case of an emergency, if we were bombed, we'd be able to prepare a lunch rapidly and Red Cross stands in different parts of the town, and each of the women is assigned a certain duty. Well, one day they decided we got a paper from Oregon where some of the women in this Oregon unit had put on an emergency lunch, timing it and seeing how long it took them. So we decided we'd do the same thing. So arrangements were made at the Presbyterian Church to put on this lunch, time everything and how we could do it. And the day of the lunch, I wasn't able to go because Bob came home. I was no better than anybody else. However, when Bob came home, I told him about it. Well, he didn't say any more, but one of the doctors anyway, who had volunteered in one of the emergency stations, his wife, who was supposed to be at an emergency station, was at the luncheon. And he said to her, "Who was at the lunch?" "Oh," she said, "Mrs. So-and-so." Well, he said, "Mrs. So-and-so should have been up at 8th and Cushman." "And Mrs. So-and-so," well, he said, "she should have been across the river." All of these women had been assigned certain posts in case of an emergency. But, of course, they all forgot that it wasn't an emergency. They realized that they thought, I should say, as it isn't an emergency, why couldn't they go to the lunch? But I was protected because I had to stay home and give Bob his lunch, otherwise I'd have been there too. Well, I think that... Is there anything else you'd like to know?
I just wanted to know if you wanted to mention a few words about the Girl Scouts at all.
Oh, yes. Did you read the...
yes, I did.
Well, I'd like to have that and maybe I could fill it in.
I think I gave it to Mrs. Davis.
In 1950, there was a meeting held of the directors of the Girl Scout Council at the Episcopal Parish Hall. Of course, at that time, I was a member of the board of directors of the Girl Scouts. And the regular camp director, whom we had hired, was unable to come in. And we were left stranded with all our arrangements made, but there wasn't anybody qualified to act as director. So Mrs. Tilley, well, you know who she is, mm-hmm. and myself volunteered that we would direct the camp if we had a recognized waterfront director, and we did have one. And we also had a trained nurse who had been an army nurse. So the four of us were able to take charge of this Girl Scout camp in 1950. And that was held at Harding Lake. And it was the first camp that was held in our own premises. We had a short time previously purchased the campsite from Mrs. Clegg. That was the second Mrs. Clegg. The first Mrs. Clegg was one who had a group of Girl Scouts out at Birch Lake in the early days, but they weren't registered as Girl Scouts. It's just that she was very interested in young girls, and they called themselves the Girl Scouts. Now, the papers and everything connected with this sale, I understand from the present director of the Girl Scouts, she hasn't got them. And I remember distinctly Mrs. Morton, Harriet Morton, and myself, we were the ones who signed the deed for this campsite. Where it is, we don't know yet, but we'll probably find it. It so happens that many of the records of the Girl Scouts are in different parts of the town. Each particular person that happened to be interested at the time and had the records just held on to them, not knowing when to give them up. There wasn't anything unethical about them. It's just a case of thoughtlessness. And I think myself, in a well-organized Girl Scout program, the thought of records, just as you have in practically everything else, is the last thing that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
The Mushroom Project, that was something that was started way before the Girl Scouts. Did I mention that in the last...
No, I don't believe so.
That started with a geographical magazine in 1920, I believe. We got a copy of the Geographical magazine, and in it there was a special article on the mushrooms in New York City.
Oh, I did tell you.
Did I tell you that?
I think you mentioned that.
Yes.
The Girl Scouts and...
Yes, and then the Girl Scouts worked on that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's anything else now.
All right.
Well, now... I think that about covers it.